angelic invocation for the receding of the waters. Anyone watching him could have seen that he would not turn back if the creek swallowed him under. It did. He was in fast water to his chest, struggling along on tiptoe, gingerly, and leaning upstream, when a log came steaming into the flat. He saw it coming and began to curse. It spun broadside to him, and it came on with something of animate ill will. "Git!" he screamed at it, a hoarse croak in the roar of the water. It came on, bobbing and bearing in its perimeter a meniscus of pale brown froth in which floated walnuts, twigs, a slender bottleneck erect and tilting like a metronome.
"Git, goddammit!"
Ballard shoved at the log with the barrel of the rifle. It swung down upon him in a rush, and he hooked his rifle arm over it. The crate capsized and floated off. Ballard and the log bore into the rapids below the ford, and Ballard was lost in a pandemonium of noises, the rifle aloft in one arm, now like some demented hero or bedraggled parody of a patriotic poster come a swamp, and his mouth wide for the howling of oaths until the log swept into a deeper pool and rolled and the waters closed over him. He came up flailing and sputtering, and began to thrash his way toward the line of willows that marked the submerged creek bank. He could not swim, but how would you drown him? His wrath seemed to buoy him up. Some halt in the way of things seemed to work here. See him? You could say that he's sustained by his fellow men like you, has peopled the shore with them, calling to him. A race that gives suck to the maimed and the crazed that wants their wrong blood in its history and will have it. But they want this man's life. He has heard them in the night, seeking him with lanterns and cries of execration. How then is he borne up? Or rather, why will not these waters take him? When he reached the willows, he pulled himself up and found that he stood in scarcely a foot of water. There he turned and shook the rifle alternately at the flooded creek and at the gray sky out of which the rain still fell grayly and without relent, and the curses that hailed up above the thunder of the water carried to the mountain and back like echoes from the clefts of Bedlam. He splashed his way to high ground and began to unload and disassemble the rifle, putting the shells in his shirt pocket and wiping the water from the gun with his forefinger and blowing through the barrel, muttering to himself the while. He took out the shells and dried them the best he could and reloaded the rifle and levered a shell into the chamber. Then he started downstream at a trot. The only thing that he recovered was the crate, and it was empty. Once far downstream, he thought he saw toy bears bobbing on the spate, but they were lost from sight beyond a stand of trees, and he was already nearer the highway than he wished, and so turned back. Ultimately, he crossed higher in the mountains, a steep and black ravine in which a wild torrent sang. Ballard, on a moss-backed footlog, bent beneath his sodden, mud-stained mattress, went with care, holding the rifle before him. How white the water was, how constant its form in the speeding flumes below, how black the rocks. When he reached the sinkhole on the mountain, the mattress was so heavy with rainwater that it staggered him. He crawled through a hole in the stone wall of the sink and pulled the mattress in after him. All that night he hauled his possessions, and all night long it rained. When he dragged the last rancid, mold-crept corpse through the wall of the sinkhole and down the dark and dripping corridor, daylight had already broached a pale gray band in the weeping sky eastward. His track through the black leaves of the forest with the drag marks of heels looked like a small wagon had passed there. In the night, it had frozen, and he came up through a field of grass webbed with little panes of ice and into a wood where the trees were seized in ice, each twig like small black bones in glass that cried or shattered in the wind. Ballard's trouser cuffs had frozen into two drums that clattered at his ankles, and in the shoes he wore, his toes lay cold and bloodless. He walked out from the sinkhole to see the day, nearly sobbing with exhaustion. Nothing moved in that dead and fabled waste, the woods garlanded with frost flowers, weeds spiring up from white crystal fantasies like the stone lace in a cave's floor. He had not stopped cursing. Whatever voice spoke him was no demon, but some old shed self that came yet from time to time in the name of sanity, a hand to gentle him back from the rim of his disastrous wrath. He built a fire in the floor of the cave by a running stream. Smoke gathered in the dome above and seeped slowly up through the myriad fissures and pores and rose in a Stygian mist through the dripping woods. When he tried the action of the rifle, it was frozen fast. He knelt on the barrel and grappled with it, tearing at the lever with his hands. When it didn't give, he threw it into the fire, but fetched it out again and stood it against the wall before it had suffered more than a scorched forestock. He crushed wild chicory into the blackened coffee pot and dipped the pot full of water. It simmered and hissed and sang in the flames, Ballard's shadow veering dark and mutant over the cupped stone walls. He brought out a pan of cornbread, partly eaten, and set it by the fire where the dry crusts lay curled like clay shards in a summer gully. In the black midday, he woke half frozen and mended up the fire. Hot pains were rifling through his feet. He lay back down. The water in the mattress had soaked through to his back, and he lay there shivering with his arms crossed at his chest, and after a while, he slept again. When he woke, it was to agony. He sat up and gripped his feet. He howled aloud. With gingery steps, he crossed the stone floor to the water and sat and put his feet in. The creek felt hot. He sat there soaking his feet and gibbering, a sound not quite crying that echoed from the walls of the grotto like the mutterings of a band of sympathetic apes. The sheriff of Sevier County came down the courthouse steps as far as the last stone above the flooded lawn and gazed out over the water where it lay flat and gray and choked with debris. Stretching in quiet canals up the streets and alleys, the tops of the parking meters just visible, and off to the left, the faintest suggestion of movement, a dull, sluggish wrinkling where the main stream of the Little Pigeon River tugged at the standing water in the flats. When the deputy came rowing across the lawn in the skiff, the sheriff watched him with slowly shaking head. The deputy swung the rear of the skiff about and back-oared until the transom banged against the stone landing.
"Cotton, you a hell of a oarsman."
"You goddamn right."
"Where the hell you been?"
The oarsman stayed the oars. The boat dipped heavily.
"You going to ride standing up like Napoleon? Reason I'm late, I had to give Bill Scruggs a ticket."
"A ticket?"
"Yeah. I caught him going up Bruce Street, speeding in a motorboat."
"Horse shit."
The deputy grinned and dipped the oars.
"Ain't this the goddamnedest thing you ever seen?" he said.
Rain drizzled lightly. The sheriff peered out at the flooded town from under his dripping hat brim.
"You ain't see a old man with a long beard building a great big boat anywheres, have you?" he said.
They rode up the main street of the town, past flooded shops and small cafes. Two men came from a store with a rowboat piled with stained boxes and loose mounds of clothing. One oared the boat, one waited behind.
"Morning, Sheriff,"
called out the man in the water, raising his hand.
"Morning, Ed," said the sheriff.
The man in the boat gestured with his chin.
"Did Mr. Parker see you?"
said the man in the water.
"We're just going up there now. Seems like trouble ought to make people closer, instead of some trying to rob others."
"Some people you can't do nothing with," the sheriff said.
"Ain't that the truth?"
They rode on.
"Take care," said the sheriff.
"Right,"
said the man in the water. They rode into the hardware store entranceway, and the deputy shipped the oars. Inside, by lamplight, people were moving about, sloshing heavily through the water. A man climbed into the showcase window and peered out at the sheriff through the broken glass.
"Howdy, Fate,"
he said.
"Howdy, Eustace."
"Biggest thing they took was guns."
"That's what they take."
"I don't even know how many. I expect we'll find stuff missing for a year." Can you get the numbers on them? Not till the waters recede, if they ever do. The inventory sheets are in the basement.
Well, it's supposed to clear tomorrow. Although at this point I really don't give a shit. Do you?
It's the worst I ever saw in my time, the sheriff said.
It was supposed to have flooded in 1885. They said the whole town was underwater.
Is that right?
So I've heard, said the deputy.
I know it's burned down about a half a dozen times, said the storekeeper. You reckon there are just some places the good Lord didn't intend folks to live in?
Could be, said the sheriff. He's got a bull-headed bunch to deal with here, if it's so, though, ain't he?
Damned if he don't.
Anything I can help you with?
Nah, hell. We're trying to salvage some of this stuff. I don't know. It sure is a hell of a mess.
Well, when you get those numbers, let me have them. They'll most likely show up over in Knoxville.
I'd rather have the sons of bitches that stole them as have the guns back.
I know what you mean. We'll do our best.
Well,
let me get my inboard cranked up here and we'll go pick up the mail.
The deputy grinned and dipped the oars into the gray water among the bottles and boards and floating fruit.
I'll talk to you later, Fate, said the storekeeper.
Okay, Eustace. I hate it about your being broke into.
Well.
They rode on up the street and beached the skiff on the front steps of the post office and went in.
Morning, Sheriff Turner,
said a pleasant woman from behind the barred window.
Morning, Miss Walker. How you?
Wet. What about you?
Ain't this something?
She eased a bundle of mail beneath the bars.
This it?
That's it.
He leafed through the mail.
You ever find any of them people missing from them cars?
When we find one, we'll find them all.
Well, when are you going to find the one?
We'll find them.
I never knew such a place for meanness, the woman said.
The sheriff smiled.
It used to be worse, he said.
Rowing back down Bruce Street, they were hailed from an upper window. The sheriff leaned back to see who'd spoke, eyes squinted against the fine rain.
You going to the courthouse, Fate?
Sure am.
How about a ride?
Come on.
Just let me get my coat. I'll be right down.
An old man appeared at the top of a flight of stairs that ascended the side of a brick store building. He shut the door behind him and adjusted his hat and came down the steps with care. The deputy backed until the rear of the skiff came up against the stairs, and the old man, taking a vicious grip on the sheriff's shoulder, stepped in and sat down.
Old woman told me today, said, it's a judgment, wages of sin and all that. I told her everybody in Sevier County would have to be rotten to the core to warrant this. She may think they are, I don't know. How are you, young feller?
Fine, said the deputy.
Here's a man could tell ye about the whitecaps, said the sheriff.
People don't want to hear about that, said the old man.
Cotton here said it sounded like a good idea to him, the sheriff said. Keep people in line.
The old man studied the rowing deputy.
Don't believe it, son, he said. They was a bunch of low-life thieves and cowards and murderers. The only thing they ever done was to whip women and rob old people of their savings, pensioners and widows, and murder people in their beds at night.
What about the Bluebills?
They was organized to set against the Whitecaps, but they was just as cowardly. They'd hear the Whitecaps was riding out someplace like Pigeon Forge. They'd get out there and take up the boards in the bridge and lay in the bushes where they could hear 'em to fall through. They hunted one another all over the county for 2 years and never met but one time, and that was by accident and in a narrow place where neither bunch couldn't run. No, those were sorry people all the way around. Every man jack a 360-degree son of a bitch, which my daddy said meant they was a son of a bitch any way you looked at 'em.
What finally happened?
What finally happened is that one man with a little guts stood up to him, and that was Tom Davis.
He was a wheel horse, wasn't he, Mr. Wade?
He was that. He was just a deputy under Sheriff Millard Maples when he busted up the Whitecaps. He made 3 or 4 trips to Nashville, paid for it out of his own pocket, got the legislature to pass a bill attaching the circuit court to the criminal court over in Knoxville so they'd have a new judge in Sevierville, and then he started after the Whitecaps. They tried every way in the world to kill him. Even sicked a big nigger on him one night, coming back from Knoxville. In them days, you could go by steamboat, and this nigger come off another boat in the middle of the river and pulled a gun to shoot him. Tom Davis took the gun away from him and just brought him on into jail. By that time, Whitecaps was leaving the county in droves. He didn't care where they went. He brought him back from Kentucky, from North Carolina, from Texas. He'd go off all by himself and be gone weeks and come in with them on a string like a bunch of horses. He was the damnedest man I ever heard of. Was an educated man. Had been a school teacher. There hadn't been a Democrat elected in Sevier County since the Civil War. But when Tom Davis run for sheriff, they elected him.
"You don't remember the flood of 1885, do ye?" said the deputy.
"Well, being as that was the year I was born, my memory of it is somewhat dim."
"But what year was it they hung them to, Mr. Wade?"
"That was in 99. That was Pless Wynn and Catlett Tipton that had murdered the Whaleys. Got them up out of bed and blowed their heads off in front of their little daughter. They'd been in jail 2 years appealing and whatnot. There was a Bob Wade implicated in it, too, that I'm proud to report is no kin of mine. I think he went to the penitentiary. Tipton and Wynn, they hung them on the courthouse lawn right yonder. It was right about the first of the year. I remember there was still holly boughs up and Christmas candles, had a big scaffold set up, had one door for the both of them to drop through. People had started into town the evening before, slept in their wagons, a lot of them, rolled out blankets on the courthouse lawn, wherever. You couldn't get a meal in town. Folks lined up 3 deep, women selling sandwiches in the street. Well, Tom Davis was sheriff by then. He brung 'em from the jail, had 2 preachers with him, and had their wives on their arms and all, just like they was going to church. Well, all of them got up there on the scaffold, and they sung, and everybody fell in singing with them, men all holding their hats. I was 13 years old, but I remember it like it was yesterday. An old town in half a Sevier County singing, 'I need thee every hour.' Then the preacher said a prayer, and the wives kissed their husbands goodbye and stepped down off the scaffold and turned around to watch, and the preacher come down, and it got real quiet. And then that trap kicked open from under 'em, and down they dropped and hung there, a jerkin' and a kickin' for, I don't know, 10-15 minutes. Don't ever think hangin' is quick and merciful. It ain't. But that was the end of whitecappin' in Sevier County. People don't like to talk about it to this day."
"You think people was meaner then than they are now?" the deputy said. The old man was looking out at the flooded town.
"No," he said, "I don't. I think people are the same from the day God first made one."
As they ascended the courthouse stairs, he was telling them how an old hermit used to live out on House Mountain, a ragged gnome with knee-length hair who dressed in leaves, and how people were used to going by his hole in the rocks and throwing in stones on a dare and calling to him to come out. In the spring, Ballard watched 2 hawks couple and drop, their wings upswept, soundless out of the sun to break and flare above the trees and ring up again with thin calls. He eyed them on, watching to see if one were hurt. He didn't know how hawks mated, but he knew that all things fought. He left the old wagon road where it went through the gap and took a path that he himself kept, going across the face of the mountain to review the country that he'd once inhabited. He sat with his back to a rock and soaked the warmth from it, the wind still cold that shivered the sparse high mountain bracken, the brittle gray ferns. He watched an empty wagon come up the valley below him.
distant clatter of it, the mule pausing in the ford, and the clatter of the immobile wagon rolling on regardless, as if the sound authored the substance, until it had all reached his ears. He watched the mule drink, and then the man on the wagon seat lifted one arm, and they commenced again, now soundless, out of the creek and up the road, and then again came the far, muted wooden rumbling. He watched the diminutive progress of all things in the valley, the gray fields coming up black and corded under the plow, the slow green occlusion that the trees were spreading. Squatting there, he let his head drop between his knees, and he began to cry. Lying awake in the dark of the cave, he thought he heard a whistling as he used to when he was a boy in his bed in the dark, and he'd hear his father on the road coming home whistling, a lonely piper. But the only sound was the stream where it ran down through the cavern to empty it, maybe in unknown seas at the center of the earth. He dreamt that night that he rode through woods on a low ridge. Below him, he could see deer in a meadow where the sun fell on the grass. The grass was still wet, and the deer stood in it to their elbows. He could feel the spine of the mule rolling under him, and he gripped the mule's barrel with his legs. Each leaf that brushed his face deepened his sadness and dread. Each leaf he passed, he'd never pass again. They rode over his face like veils, already some yellow, their veins like slender bones where the sun shone through them. He had resolved himself to ride on, for he could not turn back, and the world that day was as lovely as any day that ever was, and he was riding to his death. On a good May morning, John Greer turned out to dig a septic tank at the back of his house. While he was digging, Lester Ballard, in fright wig and skirts, stepped from behind the pump house and raised the rifle and cocked the hammer silently, holding back the trigger and easing it into the notch as hunters do. When he fired, the shovel was coming past Greer's shoulder with a load of dirt. Long after the crack of the rifle had died in the lee of the mountain, he could hear the gong of turned doom that rang above the man's head as he froze there with the shovel aloft, on which had splattered in a bright medallion the small piece of lead. The man, looking at whatever it was standing there, cursing to itself while it worked the lever of the rifle, an apparition created whole out of nothing and set upon him with such dire intent. He flung away the shovel and began to run. Ballard shot him through the body as he passed and stitched a falter in his pace. He shot him once more before he rounded the corner of the house, but he couldn't tell where he hit him. He himself was running now, cursing steadily, working the lever of the rifle again, taking the corner of the house, one foot almost going from under him as he turned and making a vicious slash in the mud, the rifle now in one hand and his thumb hooked over the hammer, mounting the steps in a crazy sort of hopping gait and rushing toward the door. He looked like something come against the end of a spring-loaded tether or some slapstick contrivance of the film cutter's art, swallowed up in the door and discharged from it again almost simultaneously, ejected in an immense concussion backwards, spinning, one arm flying out in a peculiar limber gesture, a faint pink cloud of blood and shredded clothing, and the rifle clattering soundless on the porch boards amid the uproar, and Ballard sitting hard on the floor for a moment before he pitched off into the yard. Even though Greer was shot through the upper chest himself, he wobbled from the doorway with the shotgun and down the steps to examine this thing he'd shot. At the foot of the steps, he picked up what appeared to be a wig and saw that it was fashioned whole from a dried human scalp. Ballard woke in a room dark to blackness. He woke in a room day bright. Woke in a room at dawn or dusk, he knew not which, where motes of dust passing through an unseen bar of light incandesced briefly and random and drifted like the smallest fireflies. He studied them for a while and then raised his hand. No hand came up. He raised the other, and a thin stripe of yellow sunlight fell across his forearm. He looked about the room. Some stainless steel pots on a steel table, a pitcher of water in a glass. Ballard in a thin white gown in a thin white room. False acolyte or antiseptic felon. A practitioner of ghastliness. A part-time ghoul. He'd been awake for some few minutes before he began to feel about for the missing arm. It was not in the bed at all. He pulled the sheet from about his neck and studied the great swathings of bandage at his shoulder, apparently with no surprise. He looked about. A room scarce wider than the bed. There was a small window behind him, but he couldn't see out without craning his neck, and it pained him to do so. No one spoke to him. A nurse came with a tin tray and helped him to sit erect, Ballard still trying to use the missing arm to fetch his balance. A cup of soup, a cup of custard, a quarter pint of sweet milk in a waxed cardboard box. Ballard prodded at the food with his spoon and lay back. He lay in a waking dream. The cracks in the yellowed plaster of the ceiling and upper walls seemed to work on his brain. He could close his eyes and see them anyway. Thin fissures traversing the otherwise blank of his corroded mind. He looked at the swaddled nub that poked from the short sleeve of the county hospital gown. It looked like an enormous bandaged thumb. He wondered what they'd done with his arm and decided to ask. When the nurse came with his supper, he said, "What'd they do with my arm?" She swung the tabletop and set the tray on it.
"You got it shot off," she said.
"I know that. I just wanted to know what all they'd done with it."
"I don't know."
"It don't make a damn to you, does it?"
"No."
"I'll find out. I can. Who's that feller at the door all the time?"
"He's a county deputy."
"County deputy?"
"Yes," she said. "What about the man you shot?"
"What about him?"
"Don't you even want to know if he's dead or alive?"
"Well..."
He was unrolling his silver from the linen napkin.
"Well, what?" she said.
"Well, is he dead or alive?"
"He's alive."
She watched him. He spooned up some applesauce and looked at it and put it down again. He opened the carton of milk and drank from it.
"You really don't care one way or the other, do you?" she said.
"Yes, I do," said Ballard. "I wish the son of a bitch was dead."
He ate. He stared at the walls. He used the bedpan or chamber pot. Sometimes he could hear a radio in another room. One evening, what appeared to be some hunters came to see him. They talked for a while without the door. Then the door opened and the room filled up with men. They gathered about Ballard's bedside. He'd been asleep. He struggled up in the bed and looked at them. Some he knew, some not. His heart shrank.
"Lester," said a heavy-set man, "where's them bodies at?"
"I don't know nothing about no bodies."
"Yes, you do. How many people did you kill?"
"I ain't killed nary one."
"The hell you ain't. You killed that Lane girl and burned her and that baby down in the house, and you killed them people in them parked cars on the Frog Mountain."
"I never done it."
They were quiet, regarding him. Then the man said,
"Get up, Lester."
Ballard pulled at the bed covers.
"I ain't allowed up," he said.
A man reached and pulled back the covers. Ballard's spindly legs lay pale and yellow-looking on the sheet.
"Get up."
Ballard tugged at the hem of his nightgown to hide himself. He swung his legs over the side of the bed and sat there a minute. Then he stood up. He sat back down again and gripped the little table.
"Where are we going?"
he said. Somebody in the back of the crowd said something, but Ballard didn't catch it.
"Is that all of a thing you got to wear?"
"I don't know."
They opened a closet and looked in, but there were only some mops and a bucket. They stood there looking at Ballard. He didn't look like much.
"We better get out of here if we're going. Earl's likely gone to fetch the sheriff."
"Let's go, Ballard."
They raised him up and pushed him toward the door and closed ranks behind him. He looked back once at the bed. Then they were going down the wide hospital corridor, past open doors where people in bed watched him leaving, the linoleum cold under his feet and his legs wobbling a bit as he went. It was a cool, clear night. Ballard's eyes went upward to the cold wash of stars that lay beyond the pole lamps in the hospital parking lot. They crossed the black asphalt, damp from recent rain, and the men opened the door of a pickup truck and motioned Ballard in. He crawled up in the cab and sat with his bare legs together in front of him. Men got in on either side, and the motor started, and the lights came up, and the lights from other cars and trucks down the parking lot. Ballard had to shift his knees like a child for the man to get to the gear lever. They pulled out of the parking lot and down the street.
"Where are we going?" said Ballard.
"We'll all know when we get there," said the driver. They drove out the highway toward the mountains, a caravan of trucks and cars. They stopped at a house. A man left the car behind Ballard and went to the door. A woman let him in. Inside, under the glare of a naked bulb, he could see the woman and some children. After a while, the man came out again and came down to the truck and handed in a bundle through the window.
"Tell him, put these here on," he said.
The driver handed the bundle to Ballard.
"Put them on," he said.
It was a pair of overalls and an army shirt. He sat in the truck with the clothes in his lap, and they started on up the road again. They turned off onto a dirt road and wound through low hills with black pines sprocketing across the headlights in the curves, and then they took another road, grass growing in it, coming at last out onto a high meadow where the remains of a sawmill stood in the starlight. A shed with the windows stoned lightless, stacks of gray lumber, a sawdust pile where foxes lived. The driver of the truck opened the door and stepped out. Other vehicles pulled alongside, and men began to crowd about, a subdued sound of voices and car doors closing. Ballard alone, Bear Shank in his night shift on the seat of the truck.
"Let Otis watch 'em."
"Why don't we just take 'em up here?
Let 'em sit there."
"How come he ain't put them clothes on?"
The truck door opened.
"Ain't you cold?" said a man.
Ballard looked at him dumbly. His arm hurt.
"Tell him put them clothes on." "He wants you to put them there clothes on," the man said.
Ballard began to sort through the bundle for arm or leg holes.
"Otis, you watch him now."
"Reckon we ought to tie his hands?"
"You could tie his hands to one of his legs like a mule."
"Jerry, you put that jar right back where you got it from. This here is serious business."
Ballard had on the shirt and was trying to do the buttons. He'd never tried to button a shirt with one hand, and he was not good at it. He got the overalls up and the straps fastened. They were soft and smelled of soap, and there was room inside for a whole Ballard more. He tucked the loose sleeve of the shirt down inside the overalls and looked around. A man squatted in the bed of the truck with a shotgun, watched him through the rear glass. Up on the hill by the sawmill, a fire licked in the wind, and the men were gathered around it. Ballard pushed the button on the glove box door in front of him, and it fell open. He felt among papers, found nothing. He shut the door again. After a while, he cranked down the window.
"You ain't got a cigarette back there, have ye?" he said.
The man leaned forward and held a pack of cigarettes up to the open window. Ballard took one and put it in his mouth.
"You got a match?"
he said. The man handed him a match.
"How you fixed for spit?" he said.
"I never asked to come out here," said Ballard.
He popped the match on the dashboard and lit the cigarette and sat smoking in the dark, watching the fire on the hill. After a while, a man came down and opened the door and told Ballard to get out. He climbed laboriously down and stood there in his overalls.
"Bring him on up, Otis."
Ballard at gunpoint, shuffling up the hill. He must pause to roll the cuffs of the overalls. At the fire, he stood and looked down at his bare feet.
"Ballard?"
Ballard didn't answer.
"Ballard, we're going to let you make it light on yourself."
Ballard waited.
"You show us where you put them people so they can be give a decent burial, and we'll put you back in that hospital and let you take your chances with the law."
"You got it all," said Ballard.
"Where's them bodies at, Ballard?"
"I don't know nothing about no bodies."
"Is that your last say?"
Ballard said that it was.
You got that cable, Fred?
Sure do.
A man stepped from the circle and came forward with a coiled and greasy braided steel cable.
You're going to have to tie that one arm down. Anybody got a rope in their truck?
I got one. Ask him about that, Ernest.
Yeah, Ernest.
The man turned to Ballard.
What did you want with them dead ladies? He said. Was you fucking them?
Ballard's face gave a funny little jerk in the firelight, but he said nothing. He looked about at his tormentors. The man with the cable had uncoiled a part of it along the ground. There was a ring spliced into the end of it, and the cable was pulled through in a loop like an enormous rabbit snare.
You know he was, the man said. Just take him on.
Someone was tying a rope about Ballard's arm. The steel cable slipped over his neck and rested on his shoulders. It was cold, smelled of oil. Then he was walking up the hill toward the sawmill. They helped him along, down the skids, stepping carefully, the flames from the bonfire stringing them in a ragged shadow show across the upper hillside. Ballard slipped once and was caught up and helped on. They came to rest, standing on an 8x8 above the sawdust pit. One of the men was boosted up to the overhead beams and handed up the slack end of the cable.
They ain't got him doped up, have they, Ernest? I'd hate for him not to know what was happening to him.
He looks alert enough to me.
Ballard craned his head toward the man who'd spoke.
I'll tell ye, he said.
Tell us what?
Where they're at, them bodies. You said if I'd tell, you'd turn me loose.
Well, you better get to telling.
They're in caves.
In caves?
I put them in caves.
Can you find them?
Yeah, I know where they're at.
Ballard entered the hollow rock that used to be his home, attended by 8 or 10 men with lanterns and lights. The rest of them built a fire at the mouth of the cave and sat about to wait. They gave him a flashlight and fell in behind him. Down narrow dripping corridors, across stone rooms where fragile spires stood everywhere from the floor, and a stream in its stone bed ran on in the sightless dark. They went on hands and knees between shifted bedding planes and up a narrow gorge, Ballard pausing from time to time to adjust the cuffs of his overalls, his entourage somewhat in wonder.
You ever seen anything to beat this?
We used to mess around in these old caves when I was a boy.
We did too, but I never knowed about this in here.
Abruptly, Ballard stopped. Balancing with one arm the flashlight in his teeth, he climbed a ledge and went along it with his face to the wall, went upward again, his bare toes gripping the rocks like an ape, and crawled through a narrow fissure in the stone. They watched him go.
God damn, if that there ain't an awful small hole.
What I'm thinking is how we gonna get them bodies out of here if we do find them.
Well, somebody shinny up there and let's go.
Here, Ed, hold the light.
The first man followed the ledge and climbed up to the hole. He turned sideways. He stooped.
Hand me that light up here.
What's the trouble?
Shit.
What is it?
Ballard!
Ballard's name faded in a diminishing series of shunted echoes down the hole where he had gone.
What is it, Tommy?
That little son of a bitch!
Where is he?
He's by God gone.
Well, let's get after him.
I can't get through the hole. Well, kiss my ass. Who's the smallest?
Ed is, I reckon. Come up here, Ed.
They boosted the next man up, and he tried to wedge his way into the hole, but he wouldn't fit.
Can you see his light or anything?
Shit, no. Not a goddamn thing.
Oh, somebody go get Jimmy. He can get through here.
They looked about at one another, assembled there in the pale and sparring beams of their torches.
Well, shit!
You thinking what I am? I sure as hell am.
Does anybody remember how we came?
Oh, fuck.
We better stick together.
You reckon there's another entrance to this hole he's in?
I don't know.
You reckon we ought to leave somebody to watch here?
We might never find him again.
There's a lot of truth in that.
We could leave a light just around the corner here where it would look like somebody was awaiting. Well,
Ballard! Little son of a bitch!
Fuck that. Let's go. Who wants to lead the way? I think I can find it. Well, go ahead. God damn if that little bastard ain't played us for a bunch of fools.
I guess he played 'em the way he seen 'em. I can't wait to tell these boys outside what's happened. Maybe we better odd man out to see who gets the fun of telling 'em. Watch your all's head.
You know what we've done, don't ye?
Yeah, I know what we've done. We've rescued the little fucker from jail and turned him loose where he can murder folks again. That's what we've done. That's exactly right. We'll get him. He may have got us. You remember this here?
I don't remember none of it. I'm just following the man in front of me.
For 3 days, Ballard explored the cave he'd entered in an attempt to find another exit. He thought it was a week and was amazed at how the batteries in the flashlight kept. He fell into the custom of napping and waking and going on again. He could find nothing but stone to sleep upon, and his naps were brief. Toward the end, he would tap the flashlight against his leg to warm the dull orange glow of it. He took the batteries out and put them in again, the hind one fore. Once he heard voices somewhere behind him, and once he thought he saw a light. He made his way toward it in darkness, lest it be the lights of his enemies, but he found nothing. He knelt and drank from a dripping pool. He rested, drank again. He watched in the bore of his flash beam tiny translucent fish, whose bones in shadow through their frail mica sheathing traversed the shallow stone-floored pool. When he rose, the water swung in his wasted paunch. He scrabbled like a rat up a long slick mudslide and entered a long room filled with bones. Ballard circled this ancient ossuary, kicking at the ruins. The brown and pitted armatures of bison, elk, a jaguar's skull, whose one remaining eye tooth he pried out and secured in the bib pocket of his overalls. That same day, he came to a sheer drop, and when he tried his failing beam, it fell down a damp wall to terminate in nothingness and night. He found a stone and dropped it over the edge. It fell silently, fell in silence. Ballard had already turned to reach for another to drop when he heard far below the tiny spung of the stone in water like a pebble down a well. In the end, he came to a small room with a thin shaft of actual daylight leaning in from the ceiling. It occurred to him only now that he might have passed other apertures to the upper world in the nighttime and not known it. He put his hand up into the crevice. He pried. He scratched at the dirt. When he woke, it was dark. He felt around and came up with a flashlight and pushed the button. A pale red wire lit within the bulb and slowly died. Ballard lay listening in the dark, but the only sound he heard was his heart. In the morning, when the light in the fissure dimly marked him out, this drowsing captive looked so inculpate in the fastness of his hollow stone, you might have said he was half right who thought himself so grievous a case against the gods. He worked all day, scratching at the hole with a piece of stone or with his bare hand. He'd sleep and work and sleep again. Or sort among the dusty relics of a nest, seeking a whole hickory nut among the bone-hard hulls with their volute channels cleanly unmeated by wood mice, teeth precise and curved as sailmaker's needles. He could find none, nor was he hungry. He slept again. In the night he heard hounds and called to them, but the enormous echo of his voice in the cavern filled him with fear, and he wouldn't call again. He heard the mice scurry in the dark. Perhaps they'd nest in his skull, spawn their tiny bald and mewling whelps in the lobed caverns where his brains had been. His bones polished clean as eggshells, centipedes sleeping in their marrowed flutes, his ribs curling slender and whitely like a bone flower in the dark stone bowl. He'd cause to wish, and he did wish, for some brute midwife to spald him from his rocky keep. In the morning, there was a spider web between himself and the sky. He seized a claw full of rubble and hurled it up the shaft. And again, until the web was gone, every trace, he pulled himself up and began to dig. He'd wake with his head against the wall and the stone tool still in his hand and dig again. Late that day, he loosed a thin slab of stone and let it clatter down into the hole. In wrenching it loose, he'd laid his finger open and he sat with it in his mouth, the earth's musty taste mingled with the iron rust tincture of blood. Dry dirt sifted down from the hole. He could see tree limbs against the sky. Climbing up again, he set to work, hammering now at actual stone, stratified layers of it that flaked off, Ballard using the larger chunks to pry and dig with. Before dark fell, he raised his head up through the earth and looked out. The first thing he saw was a cow. It was about 100 feet away in a field beyond the wood in which he'd risen, and beyond the cow was a barn, and beyond that, a house. He watched the house for signs of life, but saw none. He lowered himself back into his hole and rested. It was hours past dark and a black night when he finally emerged from the earth. Down at the house, there were lights. He cast about among the stars for some kind of guidance, but the heavens wore a different look that Ballard didn't trust. He crossed through the woods and climbed a fence and crossed a field until he came to a road. It was no place he'd ever stood in before. Seeing that uphill that led toward the mountains, he took the other way, and soon was hobbling along, weak but able, the night being as fine as you could wish, and a faint bloom of honeysuckle already on the air. At this time, he had not eaten for 5 days. He'd not gone far before a church bus hove into sight behind him. Ballard scuttled into the roadside weeds and crouched there watching. The bus clattered past. It was all lit up, and the faces within passed each in their pane of glass, each in profile. At the last seat in the rear, a small boy was looking out the window, his nose puttied against the glass. There was nothing out there to see, but he was looking anyway. As he went by, he looked at Ballard, and Ballard looked back. Then the bus rounded the curve and clattered from sight. Ballard climbed into the road and went on. He was trying to fix in his mind where he'd seen the boy when it came to him that the boy looked like himself. This gave him the fidgets, and though he tried to shake the image of the face in the glass, it would not go. When he reached the highway, he crossed over into the fields beyond. He stumbled his way over the clods in a new turned bottom and came at last to the river. The river woods were hung with trash and papers from the high water, the trees plastered up with silt and enormous nests of jetsam lodged high in the branches against the sky. As he neared the town, the roosters were calling. Perhaps they sensed a relief in the obscurity of night that the traveler could not read, though he kept watch eastward. Perhaps some freshness in the air. Everywhere across the sleeping land they called and answered, each to each. As in olden times, so now. As in other countries, here. It was dawn when he presented himself at the county hospital desk. The night duty nurse had just come down the hall with a cup of coffee and found Ballard leaning against the counter. A weed-shaped, one-armed human, swaddled up in outsized overalls and covered all over with red mud. His eyes were caved and smoking.
"I'm supposed to be here," he said.
He was never indicted for any crime. He was sent to the state hospital at Knoxville, and there placed in a cage next door but one to a demented gentleman who used to open folks' skulls and eat the brains inside with a spoon. Ballard saw him from time to time as they were taken out for airing, but he had nothing to say to a crazy man, and the crazy man had long since gone mute with the enormity of his crimes. The hasp of his metal door was secured with a bent spoon, and Ballard once asked if it were the same spoon the crazy man had used to eat the brains with, but he got no answer. He contracted pneumonia in April of 1965 and was transferred to the University Hospital, where he was treated and apparently recovered. He was returned to the state hospital at Lions View, and 2 mornings later was found dead in the floor of his cage. His body was shipped to the state medical school at Memphis. There, in the basement room, he was preserved with formalin and wheeled forth to take his place with other deceased persons newly arrived. He was laid out on a slab and flayed, eviscerated, dissected. His head was sawed open and the brains removed. His muscles were stripped from his bones. His heart was taken out. His entrails were hauled forth and delineated, and the 4 young students who bent over him like those haruspices of old perhaps saw monsters worse to come in their configurations. At the end of 3 months, when the class was closed, Ballard was scraped from the table into a plastic bag and taken with others of his kind to a cemetery outside the city, and there interred. A minister from the school read a simple service. In April of that same year, a man named Arthur Ogle was plowing an upland field one evening when the plow was snatched from his hands. He looked in time to see his span of mules disappear into the earth, taking the plow with them. He crawled with caution to the place where the ground had swallowed them, but all was darkness there. A cool wind was coming from inside the earth, and far below he could hear water running. The following day, 2 neighbor boys descended into the sink on ropes. They never found the mules. What they did find was a chamber in which the bodies of a number of people were arranged on stone ledges in attitudes of repose. Late that afternoon, the high sheriff of Sevier County, with 2 deputies and 2 other men, crossed the field from Willie Gibson's old rifle shop, where they'd left the car, and crossed the creek and went up the old log road. They carried lanterns and coils of rope and a number of muslin shrouds on which was stenciled "Property of the State of Tennessee." The high sheriff of Sevier County himself descended into the sink and surveyed the mausoleum there. The bodies were covered with adipocere, a pale gray cheesy mold common to corpses in damp places, and scallops of light fungus grew along them as they do on logs rotting in the forest. The chamber was filled with a sour smell, a faint reek of ammonia. The sheriff and the deputy made a noose from a rope, and they slipped it around the upper body of the first corpse and drew it tight. They pulled her from the slab and dragged her across the stone floor of the vault and down a corridor to where daylight fell against the wall of the sink. In this leaning bowl of light, standing there among the shifting motes, they called for a rope. When it descended, they made it fast to the rope about the corpse and called aloft again. The rope drew taut, and the first of the dead sat up on the cave floor, the hands that hauled the rope above sorting the shadows like puppeteers. Gray, soapy clots of matter fell from the cadaver's chin. She ascended, dangling. She sloughed in the weam of the noose. A gray rheum dripped. In the evening, a jeep descended the log road, towing a trailer in the bed of which lay 7 bodies bound in muslin like enormous hams. As they went down the valley in the new fell dark, basking nighthawks rose from the dust in the road before them with wild wings and eyes red as jewels in the headlights.
The End. You've been listening to Child of God by Cormac McCarthy, narrated by Tom Stekschulte, and directed by Inokenti Aksentiev. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends another modern classic by Cormac McCarthy, Sutri, narrated by Richard Poe. Cornelius Sutri has forsaken a life of privilege with his prominent family to live in a dilapidated houseboat on the Tennessee River near Knoxville. remaining on the margins of the outcast community there, a brilliantly imagined collection of eccentrics, criminals, and squatters, he rises above the physical and human squalor with detachment, humor, and dignity. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, so visit us at recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.